All right, welcome again. This is part three of the series, The Torah State. Tonight we discuss the economics of the Torah State, and it's sponsored again by Becky and Avi Katz, Lili Nishmas, Yonah Ben Aryeh Leib, Nishmoso, Tzur B'Tzur HaChaim. Last week we discussed the foreign affairs of the Torah State, so it's built really around two principles that we articulated. One is Bereishis Bara Elokim, that Eretz Yisrael belongs to us because of God's decision to give it to us. That's the first Rashi in Bereishis. And secondly, V'nigdashti B'soch B'nei Yisrael, that we are supposed to sanctify God's name, and that engenders a particular approach to diplomacy. That is to say, the Torah State in its policies and through its embassies and ambassadors preach the message of Torah and carry the Das Hashem across the globe. Umola Haaretz Deas Hashem Kamaim Layom Michasim. So that's the diplomatic goal of the Torah State. And it's a singular goal. Economics, in that sense, is more similar to politics, which is part one, in that there's no one approach necessarily that the Torah says you must do this or articulate this pattern. The Torah State can sustain a number of approaches to economics, as with politics. So the question then becomes, what are the preferences? What are the principles by which the Torah approaches economic policy? Now, economic policy focuses on one area, but economics really encompasses multiple areas of life. And we have to just understand a little about the basic economics first. On the simplest level, the question that economists deal with is, how does a society produce and consume? How do we make the things that we want, and how do we purchase the things that we want? How are prices set? Who gets to own? Who gets to determine this? The broader issue that exists is how does a society balance the various interests that any society has that are sometimes in conflict? So, for example, free trade. How free? What are the limits? Monopolies. Their advantages and disadvantages. Price controls on the one hand versus, on the other hand, the desire of the producer to profit and the consumer to pay as little as possible. The essential question that really determines the nature of various economic approaches to society is, how much is the government involved in the marketplace? Or some would say, how much should the government interfere in the marketplace? Now, we, of course, in America have a free market economy. That's not to say that the government is uninvolved. Our economic system and our prices are set more or less based on supply and demand. The basic rule being, if you have a low supply and a high demand, so prices are going to be high. If you have a high supply, meaning a large supply of something, and low demand for it, there'll be low prices as well. The basic belief of capitalists, as articulated first in the Western world by Adam Smith in the famous work on the Wealth of Nations, is that the free market corrects itself. No one believes it when you're going through a recession, but the free market usually does correct itself. If there's a low supply, then prices rise. Once prices rise, then more people want to produce that product in order to gain those profits, and then prices start to recede. Conversely, if there's a high supply, there'll be low prices. Low prices, low profits. Low profits, producers drop out. That's one of the secrets behind the ever-changing number of restaurants in Teaneck. It's just a question of supply and demand. All this happens until more or less a natural price is set, and the natural price is going to fluctuate again depending on what the marketplace is able to produce. But no market is completely free. A purely free market might not work, even in America, even the most capitalist society. So to give some examples that we're familiar with, for years, the government has propped up the prices of various staples, whether it's milk or corn or wheat, depending on what's needed. Otherwise, the price would be so low that it would not be worthwhile to produce. And therefore, there's an interest that government has in seeing these items produced, so they underwrite it. Sometimes in the past, they would even destroy a product, say burn warehouses of corn or wheat, in order to maintain the prices. A practice that you find first in the Gemara. We'll get to that. It's very strange. One of the more bizarre aspects of this phenomenon is that one arm of the government subsidizes tobacco, while numerous other arms rail against and penalize the use of tobacco. So how is the government paying for something they're urging people not to use? Well, that's politics. Of course, they like the tax money that comes from people who smoke also. Or, here's a case, maybe a fantasy. You would think that simply based on the marketplace, the price of a sirogim should drop within a half hour of the start of Sukkos, right? Because one Sukkah, you could charge $50, $60 for an sirogim. But once Sukkos starts, it's not really worth more than a lemon is worth, maybe a quarter or 50 cents. So why then don't people wait to the end? Well, it's then in the interest of the marketer, of the seller, not to drop the prices. And after Sukkos, or on Sukkos, just to destroy his inventory so as to maintain his prices. Obviously, everyone knew that you could get a deal on an Esrog right before Sukkos started, so people would wait. So therefore, sellers essentially take it off the market, and that's why among most sellers, such bargains are not available. The government, for example, runs certain monopolies. We all get our heating from PSE&G, I guess. Most people have oil here. Or water. If you don't want to buy the bottled water, then the water's coming from one water carrier in our area. The postal service was always a monopoly. Would prices be lower if there was competition? Well, you see from the breakup of ATT, the Bell companies, yes. Would service be as good? So that's an open question. The free market believes that private enterprise always requires greater customer satisfaction where people go elsewhere. So now we're dealing with the Yonah Dioma. What if a staple like oil, which is a very basic public need, has great fluctuations in prices that are basically unexplainable and it must be purchased? All right. Why is the price so high now? So people point to increased demand from India and China. I don't know. One of the beautiful things about economics is that if you'd ask 10 economics why the dollar is so weak today, you would get 10 different reasons for it. Another mantra of economics is whatever economists say, one of them is always right. You just don't know which one was right until long after the event has passed. So to what extent, for example, are price controls, either price ceilings or price floors, justified in the Torah? Now, economics as a study, the dismal science, deals with trade-offs, with measuring incentives, with structuring a society's financial interactions in order to obtain or to achieve the maximum benefit for the maximum number of people. So what in fact is the balance that the Torah sees? How do we strike that balance? Now again, obviously, no one can produce everything that he needs. And that's why we need the interactions of many different groups of society in order to achieve a prosperous or decent lifestyle. The Rambam already made note of this in his introduction to Seder Zerah. Very beautiful piece. The Rambam asks, Rambam says that the whole purpose of life is to pursue Chochmah, to be involved in the Muskolos, to pursue wisdom. So why then, he asks, did God create so many people who are uninvolved in that? So he gives two answers, but the first answer is because these people take care of the needs of that individual chacham. That is to say, every person to live must have food and clothing, shelter, etc. So that person would have to know how to plow and to plant and harvest and thresh and grind and cook and weave and sew and build. He would have to learn so many trades. And the Rambam says, "Ein b'chayim isu shelach." There's not enough time in the life of Meshuselach to enable a person to learn every occupation that he needs to live. And you'd have no time to learn, no time to pursue wisdom. So therefore, you have all these people who do these things. He refers to them in one context as Meshugaim almost. They're doing all these things, but for the benefit of all. So then, how do you arrange the organs of society so that these things, so to speak, are distributed efficiently? Now, one other point. efficiently is not the same thing as fairly. Fairly is a different question. So economics, like meteorology, deals with what is and not with what we would like it to be, not with our preferences. We may want warm weather tomorrow, but we're not going to blame the meteorologist if it doesn't come. So too, economics measures what is in a society and how society's institutions can interact. Now, because of that, economics often evokes a populist disdain, especially around election time. So, for example, you have, whenever there's an election, there's certain targets. So take the pharmaceutical companies today. They make too much money, right? And they're spending it all on pens they're giving away to doctors. But the fact is, they're the ones who invest the money and take the risks, and they usually lose money on most of their products, and therefore they have to make it up somehow. So under a reasonable system of economics, that's the way it's set up. Otherwise, you have a system where no one is going to invest because they'll never get a return on their investment. Or in a cycle that we see repeated now before our eyes, if you just follow the media, just have a little memory. So the liberal politicians are very quick to criticize always tax breaks to corporations. Last several years, but for many years already. You can't give tax breaks to wealthy corporations. Well, those wealthy corporations then outsource their jobs to places where they'll be able to maintain the same return to their shareholders, okay? So now these same politicians come around saying, we have to give, not breaks anymore, because that they're against, we have to give tax incentives to corporations to bring back the jobs to America. Well, had they given the tax breaks originally, they wouldn't have outsourced the jobs to begin with. But that's economics. You understand why many economists, or most economists, look at most politicians as charlatans. Now, economics deals or recognizes also a division of labor in society. That some people provide the capital, others the labor actually produce the goods, and then there are the consumers of the goods and the services, those people who purchase whatever that product is. So what does the Torah have to say about all this? Well, there are two economic systems, there are several actually, but there are two main systems that we've encountered in our lifetime. The Torah doesn't necessarily endorse any one system, but it does have certain preferences which will be apparent. Now, there are two main types. One is nicely called the centralized control system, and the other is the free market. The centralized system, which was very common in the ancient world, and of course common in the communist countries of yesteryear and the remaining socialist economies in the world today, basically put forth that the state should be in control of all property, and the state controls the means of production and the distribution of wealth. In a context familiar to all of us, young Israel, nascent Israel, was a socialist state and it remained a socialist state probably for the first 45, 50 years of its existence. So it meant that the government controlled transportation and the utilities and healthcare and numerous industries and the electronic media. We discussed last year Ben-Gurion, while he was prime minister, didn't even allow television in Israel. He felt it was for the slothful. So Eshkol had to bring in television when Ben-Gurion finally left office. The government exercised heavy control over wealth. It prohibited until the late 70s or early 80s private ownership of foreign currency. You may recall that Yitzhak Rabin ran afoul of those laws in 1977, had to resign. The government favored very extensive and obtrusive regulation of industries. It had a stultifying bureaucracy. It had onerous taxation that essentially penalized initiative if the bureaucracy hadn't penalized it already enough. Taxes reached levels of maybe 70% of one's income. And I think in other social societies, taxes were 90% of one's income, if you can contemplate such a thing. I knew a fellow, this is back in the early 80s, in the clothing business, wanted to build a factory in Israel and tried over the course of 3 years to set up a factory, could not penetrate the bureaucracy and the red tape. He didn't want to pay the amount of bribe money that was necessary, and finally just opened in Egypt, where he opened his factory within a few months. statist economies hinder development and progress and are ordinarily, although not necessarily, associated with totalitarian societies. So, in other words, a socialist state need not necessarily be totalitarian. It usually worked out that way because the free market allows for the rise of a separate power structure in society, that is, the wealthy, as opposed to only one power structure in society, that is, the government. So the government always feared that rise. You have now emerging in Singapore, in China, state economies that allow for private capitalist initiatives as well, or better said, they allow a capitalist infrastructure to take place while still exercising authoritarian control over the society. So far it's working, but of course it's made money for a lot of people, but China remains a very poor country because of the large population that they have. Socialists with a centralized control economies were always noted for lower standards of living. Motivation and ambition were reduced. There's a certain sameness about life. I remember seeing in Russia this past summer, but in London years ago, even in Tel Aviv, in the areas in the northern part of Tel Aviv, on Derech Namir and even Gabiro, every apartment building looks the same. Just block houses all look the same, because the socialist mentality was everybody is the same. Everyone's a tool of the government, tool of the state, because everyone's the same. You'll dress the same way, like they used to in China, and you'll live in the same type of building. I remember in London once, I was staying in someone's house, and every house on the street, it was all attached houses, all looked the same. And aside from the numbers, you could not tell one place from the other. Therefore, there are certain advantages to such a society. Basic needs are always cared for, jobs, housing, health care, they give you a grave, a safety net. The disadvantage is that it denies a basic aspect of human nature. But it's important to say such a system does not violate the Torah. If the society agrees to it, the society can agree to have the state control the means of production, although it clearly does not implement a number of Torah ideals, as we will see. To summarize, Winston Churchill said once that the unspoken virtue of socialism is the equal distribution of miseries. And it's true. Everybody's the same suffering. The unspoken vice of capitalism is the unequal distribution of blessings. And that is also true. Capitalism, the free market economy, is the most popular today. It's the last 25 years especially has swept through the world in a way which might not have been anticipated from the 40s through the 70s. It's usually associated with a higher standard of living, better quality of life, with the pursuit of happiness and pursuit of opportunity, and also a disparity between rich and poor, which is the unequal distribution of blessings. Government is less involved. Government only involves itself, or classically should only involve itself, to offer incentives to industry, to enact a tax policy that encourages investment and production and consumption, and occasionally, usually bizarrely, offers an economic stimulus, so to speak, during a downturn, but that really is also politician talk, and the real effect of that is arguable, or I wouldn't turn away a nickel if they gave it to me, which is, I guess, how most of the country feels. Rav Bar Ilan, in his encyclopedic work, which I quote from liberally, quotes Rav Meir Tamari, the great economist, the Talmud Chacham, who said the ideal Torah system is what he called capitalism meudan, a refined capitalism. So let's understand what that is. The Torah's approach was very advanced by ancient standards and even by modern standards as well. Unabashedly, the Torah endorses freedom of ownership of private property by everyone in society. Men, women, which is almost unknown in the ancient world, even children, even Rishoyim don't lose their rights of ownership. Non-Jews have a right of ownership in the Torah state as well. And foreigners, aliens, have a right to ownership also. And that right of ownership means an unlimited right of ownership of property. There's no limitation on quantity nor on geography. You can own any amount that you acquire legally, and you can own anything anywhere in the world. Rav Kook said, a fundamental law of the Mishpatei Torah is private ownership b'mahu shalo. What a person person owns is his. When you own something, you then have the freedom to buy and to sell and to lease and to rent and to gift and to incorporate and to have partners, even with a non-Jew in certain circumstances, all this during life, and even to direct distributions of one's assets after death, if they're covenanted before death. The Torah does not interfere with such rights, and moreover, no one in society has the right to interfere with such rights. Another fundamental principle of Torah is the freedom of competition that can exist between merchants. So, famously, the Gemara says about Metzia, Daf Samach Amud Aleph, Rabbi Yehuda said that a merchant is not allowed to undercut the market price in order to attract more business. That's Rabbi Yehuda's opinion. But the Mishnah says, the Chachamim say, not only is it mutar, is it permissible to undercut the market price, but zochur latov. A merchant who wants to do that is blessed, because as Rashi says, the prices drop for everyone. Further in that Mishnah, Rabbi Yehuda said, a merchant is not allowed to distribute kloyos ve'egozim to children. You can't advertise giving away nuts or parched corn or balloons or little gifts in order to induce the children to come and get their parents to buy there. Rabbi Yehuda says, you can't do that. It's unfair competition. Chum say, no, it's permissible. That is competition. Let some other merchant give something else away, and then the consumer benefits as well. The Torah maintains economic competition is healthy for society and healthy for the consumer. It keeps prices down and quality up. So you, mostly Teaneck residents, will ask me, what about Haslagas Gvul, which we haven't had to encounter in Teaneck in 10 years, by the way. But Haslagas Gvul does not apply in any event if prices are lower or quality is better. It only applies to a Ben Ir as well. Citizens of the same city. There are limits on outsiders. That Seber can be hurt. Makes sense. If an outsider comes in and tries to destroy an existing business, outsiders say not sending his kids to yeshiva here. He's not contributing to the shuls, the community, heir of mikvah. So there can be limitations. But generally, the consumer has free choice. He could shop in this store or that one. He has the freedom to work for the employer of his choice. Famous halacha, a dissatisfied poel worker can quit, afilu b'chatzi hayom, even in the middle of the day. Doesn't like the way he's being treated, he can walk. There's harm to the owner, so in case he has to compensate him, but usually the poel, he's not a slave, he's a poel. Yes, a slave can't leave, that's slavery. A worker, he has a right to leave if he doesn't like the way he's being treated. Of course, there's no benefit to ruinous competition. So, for example, you can't open a store that blocks customers from reaching an existing one. That would be unfair. Or you can't sell at a loss simply to drive the other person out of business, because then it would give the remaining merchant a monopoly. That's no longer business practices or competition, what the Gemara called Yored Le'umunus Chavero, simply trying to destroy someone's parnasa, and that's not a good reflection on any person. As I mentioned, we can favor a local businessman over an outsider, but that's our choice. On the other hand, you can't arbitrarily prevent an outsider from doing business, because this also benefits the consumer. The basic rule is the Torah encourages free markets, and the economy is set up in order to enable a free market system to thrive. Now, monopolies are not forbidden by the Torah, but they can be limited by the Beis Din, which governs these affairs, not the Melech. One klal which hovers over the whole economic system is the famous one of Hefker based in Hefker, that we may own our property, but Beis Din has the right to manipulate our ownership in certain ways in order to effect certain societal benefits. Obviously, certain monopolies are necessary, even in halacha, but you have in America as well. That's why there are copyright laws and patent laws, but the most famous monopoly that exists was on publishing. A lot of Torah litigation about someone, people publishing a shas, they need to recoup their investment, you know, once the plates were made for the printing press. If someone would just duplicate it, the guy's out his original investment. That can't be. Well, the Bach allowed a monopoly on alcohol because someone had to make a huge investment to set it up. Or it's very common to give the Rav or his wife a monopoly on salt or candles. He wasn't being paid a salary. See, he was given a commodity to sell that no one else was selling, so that would be his parnasa. Now, competition was maintained and prices were kept at a level that the community could support by a practice which is very common in our day. less common today than even 20, 30 years ago, but nonetheless we're familiar with it. So Gemara says in Tainis, Rav Chafam and Bey is one of the genius insights or actions of Rav Huna in Bavel, was that he would buy up himself excess vegetables on Friday afternoon and he would throw them in the river to maintain prices. So you say, why didn't you just give them to the poor? So he said, because then they would never buy anything at all. They would just wait to get this distribution. So it means the poor, not the destitute, but the poor who had money. And if the vegetables remained, the prices would drop and the whole system would collapse. So he was able to keep the prices at a level where everybody benefited, consumer and producer, by destroying every Arab Shabbos. Now, like I mentioned at the outset, every free market has limitations as well, and the Torah system does also. So, for example, there are religious limitations, which we're familiar with. Halacha, the Torah imposes certain limitations. You can't own chefze v'dezara. I know there are a lot of Jews in modern times in the cross business, the getchka business. You can't really own chefze v'dezara. You can't even keep in your possession, mentioned this past Shabbos, false weights and measures. Forget about using them. That's certainly osur. Lo yeh bekischo. You can't even own them. You can't raise pigs in Eretz Yisrael, the source of tension in Israel these days. You can't sell treif. You can't have sell immodest clothing. You can't sell yourself as an eved. You can't sell a sdeach huzah. You can't sell anything which will produce a violation of lifnei igel asitei mitzvah, to do someone else to sin. And of course you can't have any Shabbos work. Now throughout our history where Jews ran municipal affairs, you found ordinances that were enacted for particular purposes, also limiting people's rights. On one hand, because of tikkun olam. So for example, for all you environmentalists out there, the Torah in Gemara Baba Basra's extensive halachos about maintaining the environment, where in a city you're allowed to plant trees, has to be outside the walls, but where inside, where outside the walls, how much distance must there be from the walls of the city to a field that needs to be fertilized so homeowners are not affected by the smell. The Gemara goes very, very broadly into city planning, how a city should be laid out with parks, etc. So you had these ordinances because of tikkun olam, or also because of tzarchei tzibur, the community needs it. So for example, the Rosh paskind that if you had a wealthy person who owns svarim and never learned from them, and the town lacks svarim, the basin could seize his svarim so other people could learn from them. Or a very interesting case in Verona, in 1540, from the Vlad HaIr, not from the two gentlemen, they banned doing business with non-Jews until after Shachris finished. After Zman Shachris finished. Because what was happening is people came down to Shachris, but a couple of merchants would not come. And they would chop the day's business with non-Jews before the others had a chance to open up. So they ruled, you're not allowed to sell to non-Jews until after Zman Shachris. This way everybody gets a chance. Now those are religious limitations, but there are inherent limitations in government, on government as well. Government, as the Torah perceives it, cannot arbitrarily seize the private property of an individual. Government cannot impose confiscatory taxes. Government cannot even impose any economic policy that's not the domain even of the Melech. And Malchei Yisrael, the Rishayim, like Ahav, Omri, were regularly criticized for seizing people's property. Rav Menashe Klein in the Mishnah Halacha says it very eloquently. Ein shum koach ba'olam, there is no authority in the world. Lahotzi mamon rishus bailim belis sibolaza, to remove property, money from an owner without a reason for it. Lo beistin v'lo melech, neither the Jewish court nor the king. Whatever God gives a person, he acquires it lawfully. Hareza shalo, it's his. So he says, how can anyone think of seizing something from another person? Masha Kadosh Baruch Hu nasan lo, what God gave him. So too the Ramah in his Truvos and Ayin Gimel says, even the Tovei HaIr, the body that ran municipal affairs, has no right or authority except according to law to seize property from individuals. Ve'en l'rabim koach ligzol hayochid. We mentioned last week, even or 2 weeks ago, even majority rule. They can't vote and say we're going to take property from this guy just because he can't outvote us. That's against the Torah. And the Sma said that you, according to the Torah, you can only take something from another person lawfully if it's sarche kohol, but simply to redistribute wealth from this person to that person, pshita delo. What about eminent domain? This is controversial in halacha. Rav Kook said you're allowed to seize property from a person to build a highway, for example, if the rov tzibur agrees, because then we're not concerned with tainus yechidim, with the arguments of individuals, because even these individuals will benefit ultimately. So we see one of the tributes to Yoshua ben Nun was that he was mesaka in drachim v'sartia. He built roads and highways in Eretz Yisrael, the Gemara says. But the Chazon Ish says that the tzibur in such a case has to pay for the hefseid completely, whatever the loss is, as ein hayochid chayav lasas sarchei atzibur mishalo. No individual is obligated to do for the public, pay for the public's needs out of his own pocket arbitrarily. Yes? We'll get to that. What about price controls first? Let's earn some money, then we'll pay taxes on it. So price controls, the prices, as I mentioned before, are set by the market, but at times government interference is warranted, much like you find very often in a capitalist society as well. For example, for the last year, I haven't heard of this cycle, but a year, 2 years ago, when the price of oil also escalated, there was a suggestion made to release fuel from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve just to drive down the price. Fine. So government can be involved at that time in those circumstances. The Gemara dealt with something which can exist in our day as well: hoarders. So the Gemara Bava Basra pay tes amid aleph. People who would hoard a commodity just to drive up the price. So supervisors were dispatched by the Beis Din to ensure that the merchants had both accurate measures, midos u'mishkolos, and that the merchants did not hoard commodities and drive up prices, because this supervision prevents the collusion of cartels, which is usually harmful to a society. And profits are also limited depending on the commodity. Shulchan Aruch says Shalo yarviach kol echad ma sheyirtzeh. A person is not allowed simply to profit whatever he wants. Now, we know that in terms of necessaries, chaye nefesh, like wine and oil and flour, I guess you could say milk, profit is limited to a shesus, to a sixth. Now, luxuries, one can charge whatever the market bears because no one is obligated to buy it. Now, this shesus, the one-sixth, is in addition to his toil and expenses. So really, he makes back whatever he invests, and on top of that, he's allowed a sixth. But a hoarder, Otsre Peros, was comparable to a lender on interest and held in the disdain. Or a very interesting case, Gemara has in Kresos, Daf Chesem and Aleph, once the price of kinin, sword. Kinin are the dove offerings that a woman after childbirth brings to the Beis HaMikdash. The price of Kenan soared so that a pair of doves cost one dinar zov, one golden dinar, which was the equivalent of 25 silver dinars. When that happened, Rabbi Gamaliel swore, the Mishnah says, Hamaona zeh, I swear by this Beis HaMikdash that I won't sleep until the price is lowered. And Rabbi Gamaliel decreed that from henceforth, only one pair need to be brought, even if there was a whole discussion for multiple doubtful or actual births. Only one pair. By night, a pair of doves had dropped to a quarter of a silver dinar, down from one gold dinar. Think of a srogim. I live with a fantasy of getting up 1 year and saying, this year we'll buy just 10 srogim for the whole shul. All right? So instead of 600 people buying an esrog at, say, $50 an esrog, $30,000, we'll buy 10 esrog for $500 and use the money for tzedakah. All right? What do you think about that? You like it. The problem is people drop $50, you know, at Starbucks on a morning if they go with a number of people. So what are we talking about? But nonetheless, there are such tools, are such mechanisms in halacha to deal very strenuously with inflated prices, even of Jewish goods. Rashi says there in Kresos, if not for what Rabbi Gamliel did, people could not have afforded even one cane. He passed in a certain way so that the price would have to drop. Well, the Gemara says in Tainus, the Chacham not allowed to decree a Tainus, a fast, a Tainus Sibur, suddenly on a Thursday. They can't get up and announce Thursday morning, today's a Tainus Sibur. Why? Because then people will run to the stores to buy food for two meals. The meal to break the fast Thursday night, and the food for Shabbos as well. Others will think that a famine is coming, there'll be a run on food, and prices will skyrocket. Halach is then, you can't decree a fast on Thursday, so as not to induce that panic. And even today, Beis Din is still charged with ensuring that there's no profit gouging on staples. How we enforce it, though, in our day is a little different. Only competition really helps, but not if everyone charges the same thing. Now, there are basic principles that the Torah wishes to articulate when it comes to economic policy. The Torah is not committed, as I said, to any one economic system as a matter of law or policy. The Torah is one commitment. The best interest of the society, to give the maximum people the maximum opportunity to pursue financial security and well-being. So a number of measures, for example, are built into the Torah system to allow for the smooth functioning of the marketplace. These are some of the tikkunim that are necessary. Famously, heter iska, to allow people to transact loans, or the relaxation of certain laws of evidence, so as not to prevent people or inhibit people from lending money to others. Takonas Hashuk, stolen property that was purchased legally by a third party was returned to the owner, but the legal purchase is compensated by the owner, and the owner then gets restitution from the thieves. Or Takonas Hashovim, known as Takonas Morish, if a guy stole a beam or a brick and used it to build a house, so even though we say the Heshev is like Zela Sher Gazal, we don't require the builder to remove the brick and destroy the house. Rather, he's paid the value. Or, of course, the Prusbel, that debts may not be nullified at the end of the Shemitah year if they were turned over to Beis Din for collection. All of these things are based on Hefker, Beis Din Hefker. Now, these measures serve to increase commerce and trade and the efficient exchanges of property. So Chazal is a very important point. And sometimes you find that, you know, if you read the wall posts in Yerushalayim, they're not always sensitive to this. Chazal must always be sensitive to the economic implications of any decree. All right? We know it in our shul, or we have to gauge the time for the early chakras every morning, because we know people have to be at the bridge at a certain hour. So we work almost that time for chakras, depending on the day, so people will be able to get to work when they have to get to work. Even recently took into account the increased traffic at the bridge. So for example, and this I can't even figure out, so I have to do more research, the Rambam paskens openly that you can't have a leap year during Shemitah, because Shemitah imposes certain hardships on people. So you don't want to extend the year. Well, it has to be a regular year. I don't remember my lifetime a leap year coming during Shemitah, except this one. How that happened, Rambam says you can't have it, I don't know. Let's look into it. Now, all these enactments in our parlance are what we call today government regulations that ensure that other societal needs enter into the equation, not just the pursuit of profit. The goal is V'asisa ha-yosho v'atov v'enei Hashem, to do what is upright and good in God's eyes. Now, there's a purpose behind all this. Adam Smith said it when he wrote about capitalism, that economics seeks the means to allow people to supply revenue or subsistence for themselves. That's what economics does. Let a person become self-sufficient in whatever way he wishes. And it also gives government revenue sufficient for public services. So let's understand some of the needs that society has and the various occupations that would enable us to benefit from that? Well, you could tell from the Torah, obviously, that we need agriculture in society. We have to eat. The Torah envisions, and you see the Torah was originally drafted for an agricultural or agrarian society. But it's more than that. Chassam Sofer says in the Taras Moshe in Shoftim, talking about the Chozrei Milchomo, that a soldier can return from battle in order to redeem his vineyard that he planted, because the Chassam Sofer says planting in Eretz Yisrael fulfills the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. And he says there, not only Avodas Karka, not only working the land, but even Limud Kol Umanios, learning any craft, any trade, any profession, fulfills Yishuv Kavod Eretz Yisrael. So a Jew living in Israel should never have to say that I can't find a good shoemaker here, I can't find a good plumber here. That would be Chil Hashem. So learning every craft and every trade, the Chassam Sofer said, is a mitzvah. Rabbi Yaakov Emden said, of course, the first obligation Eretz Yisrael is farming, because that's literally redeeming the land. But nonetheless, every umanus is necessary. That's industry and trade. It's also known in the Torah. Baruch atah b'vorecha, baruch atah b'tzeisecha. So what does the Gemara say? That's parkamatio. That's commerce. You're blessed when you go out to do your business and when you come back. Rav Kook said, very interestingly, any nation that is only agrarian, that has no industry, will ultimately decline in development because it won't be able to sustain itself. And a society has to be able to use its natural resources, should be developed in every society. I don't want to get into my own feelings, but people lament the dearth of oil in America. Well, we're sitting on millions of barrels in the Arctic National Wildlife Preserve, which is like, it was described as if you look at a dining room table and put a postage stamp at the corner where they want to drill, that's the postage stamp. So the same people saying we have to remove ourselves from dependence on foreign oil, it's always the same people don't want to drill for oil where we know we have oil. But part of society means to uncover what our resources are. Ramban said, Umilu es ha'aretz v'chivshua. He says, ha'aretz v'chivshua, to conquer the land means to extract from the ground what's there. That's the way God set up the world system. Now, there are not many natural resources in Israel, unless you can find a profitable use for sand and rocks. All right, there's potassium in the Dead Sea, so then the Torah state has to exploit its human capital, brains, high-tech, etc. The Torah advocates that the economy of the Torah state be a flourishing one. What economists call positive externalities, things that happen almost indirectly as a result of one act or one good. Rav Kook said, if the economy flourishes, then Torah flourishes. When the material forces in the society are strengthened, then the spiritual forces are also strengthened. It just stands to reason. People are less desperate, less materialistic. It's just there, and they could focus on more lofty pursuits. Talmud Torah benefits. Prosperity gives people more time to learn. That's the benefit of Mashiach. In the famous Gemara that says that in the future, gluskos and klei melas will hang from trees, loaves of bread and suits of silk will hang from trees, we'll just pluck it off the tree, it'll be there. So the Rambam explains that to mean something we already know in our day, we live and breathe. Commodities will be readily available for us. If you want a suit, you want a loaf of bread, you don't have to struggle, go find grain, grind it, bake it. Weave your own suit. It's there. You do your thing, earn your own money, and you go out and buy it. When goods are plentiful and easily obtained, you have more time to learn. It's also now, Rama says at the beginning of Perek Tes and Hilchos Tshuva, if we're worthy, God provides us with sova, satisfaction, shalom, peace, and ribui kesev izov, an abundance of gold and silver, so that we need not preoccupy ourselves with physical pursuits, but we're penuyim lilmod b'chokhmo v'lasos ha-mitzvah. We're free to learn, free to do mitzvahs. So the individual is better off when society flourishes. Society is better off. A beautiful medrash in Miketz. Aro had his dream. He dreamt of the seven fat cows, Vaterena Ba'ochu. He saw them grazing in the meadow, Vaterena Ba'ochu. So the Midrash there says, in Bereishis Rabba, when there's prosperity, everyone becomes Achim Elu La'elu. When there's prosperity, everybody is a brother, everyone is a friend. Conversely, poverty unleashes unrest and discontent to society. The bottom line is, wealth creates jobs. And a flourishing economy in the Torah state is also Kiddush Hashem. If Jews are successful in a national context, then it shows the nations of the world the superiority of the Torah idea. That in fact religion is not a private matter that just exists between me and God and my home and nowhere else, but in fact divine service is a public good. And the Torah is able to engender a society which is moral and perfected and a positive reflection on God. Correct choices, therefore, will produce an economy in which social needs are cared for, public health, security, environment, foreign affairs. That's the Torah state. It's a busha, really, that the Jewish state, for so many years, has been perceived by the world as a welfare state, receiving charity from nations, even from America, for many, many years, and dispatches people by the thousands to collect money for one cause or another, and sometimes even subsistence. Rabbi Wein once said it publicly, that's why I could say it, that the state of Israel for years has been one big schnarr, from the prime minister on down. It's no different, hat in hand, in a way you don't really find in other countries in the world. I read that a receptive audience in world Jewry, but nonetheless, it's not the way it's supposed to be. In a successful Torah state, we can assist poor nations, who are then more receptive to the Torah idea. What are the obligations of the individual in such an economic system? Well, the Rambam says in Parak Vav of Hilchos Gzela, Halacha Yud Aleph, Ein roi la'adam sheyasa kol yomav ela b'divrei chachma uv'yishuva shel olam. Rambam says it here in Parak Vav Hilchos Gzela, it's appropriate for a person to involve himself throughout his life only in matters of wisdom and yishuva shel olam, the settlement or civilization of the world. What does that mean? It means chachma and malacha, work. So Rav Kook said, yeshuva shalom includes necessities, meaning we have to work for food, clothing, shelter, but also, he says, to work for achavas das, which varies from person to person. Things that bring us satisfaction, contentment, and inner joy in life, those are the mosaros, luxuries that people have. Each person needs different things. And also, he says in Arot HaKodesh, l'shaper tachayim, to improve life. We don't believe in asceticism, nor do we believe necessarily that you should just try to get by with as little as possible. No, on the contrary. A person is allowed to enjoy life. That's why God gave us life. It also means that we have to perfect the world and plug the gaps in the world and bring the world closer to the ideal goal. But that's only going to be if a person has an inner satisfaction and inner contentment about life and is not either jealous on the one hand or angry on the other hand about the way life is treating him, whether others have more, he has less. No. Yeshuva Shalom means that a person is comfortable both in his own skin and with the rest of society as well. So it says in Avos, Yofet Talmud Torah im Derech Eretz. Talmud Torah is good, along with Derech Eretz, the way of the world. So Rabbi Yosef Yaivitz, the famous Golei Sefarad, said that Yofet Talmud Torah im Derech Eretz, that you would think Torah is so desirable that you don't need anything else. No. That's what the Mishnah comes to say. It's Yofa im Derech Eretz. And the Kolbo, one of the Rishonim, wrote that a person who works is involved in Yishuv Olam. And that itself is a mitzvah gedola. And that's also why he says they're from the Chozrei Milchama as well. Rav Kook said beautifully, every malacha, every job, every craft, every profession, every occupation involves tikkun olam, some repair of the world, perfection of the world, as well as hidrachavut or hakodesh, the expansion of the holy light of God. And he says every move, every tenuah, every move that a person makes that liberates part of the universe from tohu, from chaos or void, is great and fundamental. And you see, Yaakov Avinu, Rome even were praised for coins, for their marketplaces, for their bathhouses. This is civilization. It fulfills what the Navi Yeshayahu said, Lo tohu v'ra'ah. God did not create a world that should remain empty and chaotic. Lo shevas yitzara. He formed it so that we should settle it, that we should exploit its resources. And the Kuzari says, and this is quite a mantra for today, he says, Cholila v'cholila. God forbid that Chachmei Yisrael should flee, Livroach o Lavriach, should flee or cause Jews to flee from the Chochmos that are needed for Yishuv Olam. But on the contrary, Jews have to be involved in the study of wisdom in order to assist in developing the world. Rav Kook said this is part of the technological development that exists to serve mankind. And Rav Aviner said more recently, this is what in our day is the pursuit of scientific excellence. So in fact, government has an obligation to foster a social and economic climate in which human progress is facilitated. Granted, this concept is not widely accepted today, amongst others, even in the Torah world, where many in the Torah world pride themselves on a lack of secular knowledge and on an ability to avoid work. But in fact, if that becomes the norm in the Torah world, so that just tells us the extent to which the Torah state is distant from us. Because such an approach is really the antithesis of Torah. It's very strange, it was unheard of in the past, and it's certainly not reflective of normal life in the Torah state. So what about Torah study in the Torah state? Talmid Chacham are indispensable to Torah society. Of course, in the past, we know from the Gemara, even they worked. One means of honoring a Talmid Chacham, the Gemara says, is lasas parkamatia b'talmid Chachamim, to do business with them. If you give them business, they have more time to learn, more time to teach. But the implication is they're doing business. But there are certain sources that point to the institution of support for Talmid Chachamim. Rabbeinu Yonah says in the Shari Tshuva and Shar Gimel that a person who learns and teaches and can support Talmid Chachamim and doesn't, so he's in the class of Oror Asher Lo Yakim Zivar Torah Zos. He's cursed for not supporting Torah, and even more if he doesn't learn. If he doesn't learn, it's almost an act of penance. He should have to support Talmid Chachamim. And the Rashbat said that it's an obligation, it's a chova, to support Talmid Chachamim and judges, the chavod, if Torasam umanasam, if Torah is their business. Conversely, in the time of the Beis HaMikdash, you never heard of such an institution as public support or separate support for Talmid Chachamim. You never had that. They're not supported from the Lishka in the Beis HaMikdash. There was no separate kupa in every Jewish society to support Talmid Chachamim. On the contrary, they all worked. Hillel worked, Rabbi Yochanan worked, Rabbi Yitzchak worked, Rabbi Papa worked. They all had jobs. They all were often called by their jobs. Rabbi Yochanan Sandlar, the shoemaker, Rabbi Yitzchak Nafcho, the blacksmith, they all worked. No one says it more forcefully, nor are his words more ignored, than what the Rambam says in Hilchos Talmud Torah, Perek Gimel Halacha Yud, Kol Ameisim Alibo, Sheyasok B'Torah, Velo Yasem Halacha, a person who thinks to himself that he's only going to be involved in Torah and not work at all, the Yisparneis Min HaTzedakah, and he'll support himself from charity, it's the Rambam. Hareza Chilas Hashem, he's desecrated God's name, Ubozes HaTorah, and he has mocked the Torah, V'kova Me'or HaDas, and he's caused the light of the faith to be extinguished, V'goram Ra La'atzmo, and he's caused evil to himself, V'notal Chai V'nolam Abba, and he's forfeited life in the world to come as well. All this, just to summarize, because he makes it seem as if a full Torah life is incompatible with the so-called real world, and that itself becomes a Chil Hashem. The Maral says in Avos, very simply, Avos HaMalacha, it causes a loss of Kavod HaTorah, and it forces the Rav, he's not working, to refrain from rebuking the community because he will lose his job. I've heard of those things happening. So according to this, there's no chiyuv at all to support someone learning. The private arrangements, he suffers zvul, it's different. The person, a businessman says, I want to support X in learning. That's mutter, it's also commendable. Rav Shechta said a month ago that just people should know there's no chiyuv to support every kol in the world. None. You could support Talmud Torah of your choice, but every guy comes for this kol of 10. That kol of 10 is no obligation in the world to give him a nickel. But the Shulchan Aruch says in Yerodei, Reish Nun Aleph, Siftes, you should give preference in tzedakah to Talmidei Chachamim, but the Talmid Chacham cannot seek any advantage or benefit. I mean, he can't go around asking for it, but it's a mitzvah to give him. You see, Shaul HaMelech supported Talmidei Chachamim, even Achav supported Talmidei Chachamim, as did the Reish Galusa. Today, of course, the Maral is right, and it does cause a loss of Kavod HaTorah. In fact, it leads to contempt for Torah in public. People are called parasites. So you see, that has to be reckoned with. The ideal is to work and to find a work that is undemanding and that is comfortable so that a person will be able to teach Torah as well. It is true, Talmidei Chacham are given certain financial breaks. They'll pay taxes, most taxes. They don't have to participate in building fences or walls, fortifications, or digging ditches. They're exempt. What about army? It's a question in and of itself. In a modern case, we'll leave that for another time. The Marsha says, interestingly, in Shavuos, Daf Lamed Hei Amud Beis, that Shlomo's army freed anywhere from between 200 and 1,000 Talmidei Chachamim just to learn Torah. But the implication is that some were freed, not everyone. Others had to fight as well. The Radak says, you read this in my book, Ein Shas Talmud Shas Milchama Shas Talmud Torah. Wartime is not a time to learn. You have to have priorities. People are coming to attack you. You have to fight. On the other hand, the Gemara says in the Darm Daf Amud Beis, Amud Beis, that Avram Avinu was punished because he drafted Talmidei Chachamim into his army. She'asa Angaria b'Talmidei Chachamim in order to save Lot. Asa HaMelech was punished for the same thing. On the other hand, after an octopus already, the eighth hand, the Radvaz says in his Truvos that there is no category, no din today of a Talmud Chacham that will be exempt from protection, taxes. Torasam Umanasam doesn't exist anymore today as it did in ancient times. The Torah state does have an institution of people who are set aside to serve God, teach His ways. The end of Hilchos Shemitah says this. It's the Kohanim and Leviim on the one hand, and all those who yearn to serve God, they could be in that class too. It's an open question what will happen when the Torah state is reconstituted. Something tells me that this issue was fought over in ancient times as well, that it's not new. All right, finally, what about tax policy in the Torah state? So we know, I don't want to depress anyone, but a Jew is obligated to pay taxes. A person doesn't pay taxes is considered a gazlan. The Rashbat says every citizen is considered a balchov. He's a debtor. He has to pay because he benefits from the services of government. So in fact, he's stealing from the government if he doesn't pay, and he's stealing also from his fellow man who has to pay a greater share if he doesn't pay. It's worse, it's unconscionable, when the tax cheats are wealthy people, is officer of Nasan, because then the poor and the middle class have to pay a greater share. Rav Vosner said, very interestingly, if there are any people who are litigious out there, this could be an occupation itself. He says, any individual Jew can lodge a private claim against the tax cheat. If the latter's non-payment of taxes results in a greater tax burden to himself, or a loss of services he would otherwise have because government had to cut back. So any person can take another person to base it and say he's not paying his share. All right, if you want to do that, it's up to you. But, it's big but, taxes must be for the purposes endorsed by the Torah, and the basic rule of the Torah's attitude towards money is a Torah chasa al mamonam shel Yisrael. The Torah has mercy on our money. Torah has mercy on our money. It doesn't take the Jewish people's money lightly. That's why there's such a category in halacha as hefsed merubo, because the Torah has compassion on us. So this is also interpreted to mean, as I said before, the Chazal must be very sensitive to the economic implications of any decree. Government cannot squander tax money, and if it's squandering, it's arguable whether it has to be paid in the Torah state. It must be used only for societal necessities, and even then the taxes can't be too onerous. People who work should be able to enjoy the fruits of their labor. It's very odd, you know, in America, we work now well into the month of May just to pay the government, whether federal, state, or local. The American Revolution took place with a British tax rate that was far, far lower than the tax rate we pay today. They said the issue was representation. All right. The fact is we pay much higher rate of taxes, exorbitantly higher than they paid in colonial times. Now, the Torah endorses a pay-as-you-go system. That is to say, you can opt out. There's certain services society provides. You don't want it, you don't have to pay for it. You pay for the services that you need, even if you're poor. And you don't have to pay for what you don't need, even if you have the money. So one classic case, which is a good illustration, if the town is buying one esrog, which is very common in Europe, by the way, they buy one esrog, a woman does not have to contribute to that. It's a tax on the town, but a woman is not obligated in esrog. She doesn't have to pay for it. The Torah also envisions a progressive tax system. It's a question Alan asked before. The more you earn, the more you pay. It's not just a flat sum, like a poll tax, that everyone is assessed. And it's not necessarily at a flat rate either. In many communities, the rate of taxation varied depending on a person's wealth, what they thought they could get out of a person, much like a skilled fundraiser knows how to do. The wealthy were taxed more than the poor. The Jewish governments in ancient times were no less creative than the governments today with a wide variety of taxation, mas mamon, mas oved, taxes of money, income, taxes you have to give some of your crops to the king, taxes you have to give some of your labor to the king. There was an income tax, a head tax. There were taxes that the Gemara mentions, the Rambam did not know what they were, could not describe them. Government, we know, will always find new and creative ways to tax. Now, taxes in the Torah state are used for defense, for roads, for shuls, for Sifrei Torah. Taxes are permitted as long as they're moderate, and the collection has to be the Darkei Noam. It has to be pleasant. People should not feel that they're under the gun. So, are Torah economists supply-siders? Well, just a brief introduction. So the theory is that high taxes on the wealthy are self-defeating, because then they're less likely to invest. When wealthy people have more capital, they invest. It creates jobs, creates prosperity for all. In the famous words of President Kennedy, a rising tide lifts all boats. So when wealthy people build more factories, more people have jobs, consumers spend more, and it just feeds itself. Today, of course, they quote Kennedy for everything but that, and that's become a Republican philosophy. The theory is that low tax rates stimulate investment and ultimately government revenue as well. Now, both Kennedy and Reagan put that to the test, and in fact, despite what you might read, they both proved it true. Under Reagan, revenues increased dramatically in the first years after 1982. By 85, it was 60-70% more than it was in 82. The problem is the deficit mushroom, because spending increased dramatically in a half. And that's a different side of the equation. The Torah, though, endorses this basic notion. Economic incentives increase efficiency, and Chazal, the Beis Din, the organs of the state, are allowed to implant these economic incentives in order to increase efficiency. So taxes are a necessary evil, but they do provide revenue for social needs. The Medrash HaGadol says that God says to the Melech, keep taxes low and reasonable, because L'sakein olami samti locha malchus ba'aretz, I made you the king to perfect my world, v'lo lehara olami, not to harm my world. So in summary, the economic system of the Torah state is designed to maximize the good of the Jewish society, to provide people with the freedom to seek pleasure and contentment in life, and personal satisfaction as well. So part of that is freedom of occupation. The Chovos HaLevavos writes at the end of the third parak of Shar Bitachon, a person is allowed, encouraged, to seek the type of work that pleases him. Everyone, the Chovos Rabbeinu Bachya said, has an inclination to one activity or another for various tasks or trades that God implanted in a person's nature. One who finds that and who physically can do it should. So the Torah system rewards individual effort. It allows for economic freedom and pursuit of prosperity as a means to allowing a life of divine service. It protects the consumer, it encourages competition, it keeps social spending low, and it also acknowledges that the person who enjoys the fruit of his own labor is fortunate in this world and the next world. Ula said in the Gemara Brachos Daf Ches Amud Aleph, you don't see this on the entrance of many yeshivas either these days. Better is the one who benefits from the toil of his own hands than even one who is just God-fearing. Better! Why? Because a person who works, work provides an individual with a greater dependence on and attachment to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that's what we seek. To be Yirei Shamayim in the abstract, in the ivory tower is one thing. To be like the greatest Yirei Shamayim, Chazal said, of farmers. Because from one year to the next, they don't know what's coming. The Maral said, even stronger, saying, Avos, Ehoves HaMelacha, he said, you have to love your work. It's not enough just to choose work. That we say it's enough to choose a work, choose a job. No, it's not enough to choose a job. You have to love what you do. That's Ehoves HaMelacha. The Gemara says in Psachim, Daf Kuf Yud Gimel Amud Aleph, Pshot Nevelta B'Shuko V'Kabel Agra. It's better to flay carcasses in public for money than to be on the dole. A person should better do that than to say, Kahana Ana, Gava Rabba Ana, I'm a Kohen, I'm a great person, it's beneath me to do this job. Rav Moshe said in the fourth Chalek of Igros Moshe, Siman Lamed Vav, it's not Bittul Torah to go to professional school for a career. It's not Bittul Torah. On the contrary, that is part of the Torah system, because that's Yishuv Olam. Would that were more universally understood. Rabbi Elie Mizrahi, the great chief rabbi of Turkey in the late 15th century, early 16th century, said, for example, you cannot prohibit melamdim, that people teaching yeshivas, who worked in the afternoon teaching chochmas yevonis in Karaite schools to make more money. And he said, you can't stop them, because the Torah endorses freedom of occupation. That's also part of the system of economics in the Torah. All of this ensures an economy that allows people to be successful and enables the society to elicit the very best that a human being can contribute to the world. So what then do we do about the poor, about the downtrodden, about the ones who are left behind in the prosperous Torah state that I have enunciated before you tonight? That is the Torah state and social justice, and that is next week. Thank you very much.